Welcome to Book Talk. This is Alan Farley, and this week it's all about the Obama campaign. Stay tuned. This is Alan Farley. Joining me is Rick Hertzberg from The New Yorker magazine with his latest book, Obamanos, The Birth of a New Political Era. Welcome back to KALW.
It's nice to be back.
Well, you know, I saw this book, and immediately I wanted to book you to talk about it without even looking in it. And what I thought, well, it'll be interesting. I can skim through this because I mean, I know what you've been writing about. But when I started reading it, I couldn't put it down.
Ah, is that so nice to hear?
And it's great to just relive that era, the last couple of years, or I guess the last 4 or 5 years, when it goes back to the 2004 convention when Obama first came to the national attention. Mm. But so, and how much of this actually has appeared in New Yorker? Was it mostly, or
essentially all of it, except for the introduction? And it's a selection from all the stuff I did over that period. And when I started to work on it, I was kind of surprised that it actually did sort of hang together and fall into an orderly pattern with its three parts: the last Bush administration, which
the
I
wreckage.
Call the wreckage, right?
Yeah.
And then the long primary campaign, the marathon, and the general election campaign, the sprint. And they're all of sort of equal length, and it kind of builds.
What I saw, I mean, you mentioned dates, and dates were not two a week or two apart, which is what it would have been if it had been in the New Yorker. So is this dated within pieces in the New Yorker?
It's dated. The book consists of the pieces for the printed magazine, and then blog items. I started a blog. This new form of,
right.
of journalism, which I was dubious about at first, and which I certainly didn't think I'd end up writing anything in a blog that a respectable publishing house like the Penguin Press would consider worthy of being put in hard covers. But the blog let me follow a lot more of the minutiae of the campaign than the biweekly, essentially biweekly formal essays in the magazine. So, and I dated the pieces, by the way, when they were written.
Rather than
the cover date of the magazine, uh-huh. which, as your listeners may or may not know, usually the cover date of a magazine is the last day that it'll be on sale anywhere. So hence the fact that we're looking at December issues of magazines right now, and they're always dated pretty far ahead, a week ahead usually for weeklies.
Well, what was it like for you reliving that experience?
It was kind of like living it. It was, I was putting the book together before the administration really got started in earnest, or as it was getting started in earnest. It had not yet hit the trench warfare, the sort of disheartening collision with this energized extreme right wing that it's involved in now. You know, we're in a stage, it feels now like the First World War, whereas the election felt like VE Day.
Yeah, it's such an exciting story and such a remarkable story. You say the birth of a new political era.
And of course, it remains to be seen whether it really will be a new political era. Eras usually have to be identified in retrospect rather than at the beginning. But I think there's good reason to believe it is a new political era. That the long conservative ascendancy, generation long, is giving way to a progressive ascendancy of some sort. That doesn't mean there won't be bumps for progressives any more than there weren't bumps for conservatives during their time on top. They had plenty of setbacks too. Didn't get their own way on everything, but it does feel like that cycle is at at a beginning. And if so, it'll be somewhat similar in a way to the Reagan cycle, in this sense that Reagan was elected in spite of being a conservative, I think. He was elected essentially in reaction to Carter, to my old boss, Jimmy Carter. He was elected because he wasn't Carter. And Obama, in many ways, in fewer ways probably, but still in many ways, was elected because he was not George W. Bush or the heir to George W. Bush. Without Bush, it's hard to imagine Obama. And without, I have to say, Carter, it's hard to imagine Reagan.
One of the, I mean, there's, of course, a number of storylines going through here, not only Obama, but the story of Hillary Clinton and John McCain and Sarah Palin, mm-hmm. of course, have featured supporting roles in this story.
Yeah, it's a pretty great cast, isn't it? It's really a great cast.
I guess the Clinton, and well, the Clintons figure so prominently in this, and the mistakes that were made by her campaign.
And you have to feel for her. I mean, I think she's ended up in, as they say, a good place right now. I think she's in a job that she's really enjoying and well-suited for, and I'm so glad that Obama appointed her and so glad that she said yes. But you have to feel for her. If there was no such person as Barack Obama, she would be president of the United States right now. She was ready to make history in this huge way of being the first female president of the United States, and Obama came along and trumped her. So good for her for not going to pieces over it, and for picking the pieces up and taking what seems to a job that she seems to like better than she liked being a senator, certainly, and maybe better than she liked being a presidential candidate.
You back at the time when at the the convention and when it was thought about, there was talk about her, you know, that he should take her as his vice president. And I thought, and I think a lot of people thought, oh, that would be awful. You'd have Bill hanging around.
I had the same thought. I certainly had the same thought that the Clinton marital drama was not something that we needed another 8 years of.
But somehow that doesn't seem to be a factor now at Secretary of State.
Isn't that curious that you're right? And I think it's partly because there are a lot of reasons. I mean, one is that she's all over the world, and she is not the power or the ultimate power in the administration. And she doesn't get the kind of scrutiny that a president gets. There'd be a lot, the right and the Fox Newses of the world would be all over Bill Clinton if Hillary were president. If you think they're treating Obama badly, they'd treat Hillary just as badly, maybe in a little bit of a different way, but just as badly, just as cruelly, and with just as many lies and libels.
And the story of John McCain, how did your view of McCain change during the campaign?
Well, I kind of felt sadder and sadder about John McCain. I'd spent a little time with John McCain in 2000 when he was in New Hampshire on the Straight Talk Express, and like all the other reporters, I was charmed. I was seduced. I admired McCain. I knew that he was a conservative with a conservative record, but I couldn't help noticing that every time he actually applied himself to think through an issue, that was when he ended up on the Maverick side. To use ideological shorthand, he'd go liberal when he really thought about something. And even though I was very passionately wanted the Democrats, whoever it was, to win in 2008, as a citizen, I was glad that McCain prevailed over these other Republican candidates. And then the campaign, which sometimes brings out the best in people, brought out the worst much of the worst in McCain. The choice of Sarah Palin was the most alarming thing that he did during the campaign, because that suggested a kind of devil-may-care irresponsibility and willingness to roll the dice or to draw to an inside straight, whatever metaphor you want. When you control a big nuclear arsenal in a very large country, that can be very dangerous. So it, and then there was the kind of sad spectacle of him, and perhaps I'm projecting this on him, but of him kowtowing to the worst elements in his party and going along with, at best, the ugliness of the campaign that the Republicans mounted. So it was a sad thing to see. It was a sad thing to see McCain dirty up his character with such energy and if not enthusiasm. I never detected a lot of enthusiasm from him when he was running, but he did his best, I guess.
We're talking with Rick Hertzberg about his book, Obamanos. And, I mean, there one of the chapters has to do with sort of a checklist of a flip-flop checklist. Of, well, now, did Obama really flip-flop on this issue, or did he just adjust his view on something? And I think you come down to maybe there was one significant change in his views, whereas I'm not sure you did the same kind of checklist for McCain, but McCain obviously made some major changes.
Yes, I don't think I did a formal checklist, but a sort of a running checklist. And there was an awful lot of that, you know. His great. He was very proud of his role in promoting immigration reform, and he ended up saying that he'd vote against the very bill that he sponsored. He had been somebody who was willing to defend the notion of progressive taxation. He abandoned that. He'd voted against the Bush tax cuts. As a candidate, he said it would be a catastrophe if they were not extended. So there was example after example of this, and it really wasn't enough to energize the right by itself. Though the Palin choice did do that, but it energized the other side too. Palin's ability to energize worked both ways.
Certainly think that some of the great moments in the story are the when he accepted the nomination.
God, that was some night. Yeah, I was in the at the Mile High Stadium that night, up in the bleachers there with my wife and my then 10-year-old son, and that the sight of that extraordinary that stadium. Absolutely filled to the rafters with ecstatic people.
A lot of tears.
A lot of tears. I mean,
me too.
You know, the faces were wet everywhere, and you know, and it wasn't the best speech he ever gave by a long shot, but it was, what a moment when he came out there, and then when Michelle came out and the girls. And this huge, huge happy crowd and the fireworks, and you know there was a lot of. It was a pretty gutsy move to do it this way, to have the acceptance in this grandiose setting, this enormous. It's the kind of thing that could easily have backfired, and Fox News did its best to make it backfire. If you remember, here's a detail I'd forgotten, until this moment. But remember the whole fuss over the Greek temple.
Right.
The set that was built for that night of the convention, and that had to be kind of de-Greeked or toned down a bit, but Obama made a number of those gambles, but they were in a way that you could say they were McCain-like gambles. His trip to Europe and the speech that he gave in Berlin, maybe the most prominent example of that, of a risky move, of an audacious risky move. But unlike McCain's gambles, that one paid off in the end, even though it did hurt him in the polls in the immediate. I mean, his polls went way up in the rest of the world, but they took a hit back home. But I think that ultimately, when people had a chance to think about it for a while, they thought, well, which would I rather have, a president who is wildly cheered by a giant crowd of Europeans, or a president who was booed by a giant crowd of Europeans? And they decided, even though they may not like Europe that much and think Europe's a bunch of wimps and smart alecks and socialists and all that, on the whole, they'd rather be cheered.
Well, another great moment in the campaign was his speech on race, which in a sense he was forced to do, but it was really a good thing that it happened.
In the end, it sure was, and it too is a sort of incident, a scene that sums up a lot of what was magic about this campaign, because the Reverend Wright stuff. It's hard to imagine a worse situation for a presidential candidate of any race to have spent a decade or two and been married by a pastor who is on tape yelling, "God damn America! God damn America!" Doesn't get a lot worse than that. That should have killed his candidacy dead. And instead, Obama, that was one of the times when Obama's steadiness of character came through. The hysteria that was surrounding that incident, the craziness, the hair-pulling that was going on, he was calm. He thought about it for several days. He sat down and wrote this speech. He made a speech that I don't know how many people actually heard or read the speech. I think that the political class heard and read it, the commentating class heard it and read it, and were so bowled over that the news that Obama had given an extremely thoughtful speech that treated Americans as adults, that much trickled down to the broad public. He saved his candidacy and strengthened his candidacy in the end because of that. And I guess the only cost he paid was this notion that, oh, he's all talk. But, you know, presidential candidates, generally speaking, are all talk.
I guess one of the mistakes, gambles that McCain made that was a mistake was in attempting to postpone the debate.
Absolutely, yeah. That was... And at first, it seemed like the Sarah Palin move. When I first heard about it, I'm a jumpy, rabbity kind of person. You know, I'm not a calm Barack Obama, a steady hand at the tiller type. I'm more of a, oh my God, everything's going to hell. And I thought when he did that, I thought, oh my God, it's a master stroke. You know, he's seizing the baton here. How on earth is Obama gonna handle this? What can he do? He can either say, "No, it's not important. No, the economic crisis is not important enough," or he can say, "Yes, yes, Mr. McCain, I'll do whatever you say." But no, I mean, he said with one line, when he said, "I think a president has to be able to do more than one thing at a time." With that one line, it was like Zeus hurling down a thunderbolt. It was just extraordinary. God, thinking about it, it certainly, those were the good old days. Huh?
Yeah, I mean, gee, I'm thinking now with what happens fast forward now to today rather than what's covered in the book, just the problem, you have a so-called supermajority in the Senate.
Yeah.
You've got a big majority in the House. And yet you can't get things done. It just makes me think back to the days of Sam Rayburn and Lyndon Johnson. I mean, if you're a Democrat, you vote the way that the party says to vote, and that's it.
Well, that's how we remember it in the fog of time. But in fact, Johnson had a much bigger Democratic majority. Now, a lot of that Democratic majority were Southern racists, but he also had a lot of liberal Republicans,
yeah,
too. So he actually had a bigger working majority. And and what he was trying to do with civil rights did not, he was not up against as many entrenched material economic interests as Obama is with health care. And then on top of that, there's the fact that although the Democrats have a majority, they don't actually have, there's not actually a progressive working majority in the Senate because of filibusters. And the big problem and the big arena for reform, the next step of reform, procedural reform, should be doing something about the filibuster. This is an outrage.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it used to be, two-thirds? And
it was
changed to 60 votes, but still,
But in the course of changing, it was made into a routine weapon.
Right, which it never was in the past.
That's right. It was reserved for extraordinary times, and you actually had to do it.
Right.
You actually had to keep
debating. When has there actually been a filibuster? It's always been a threat.
Yeah, there hasn't been one since... there hasn't been a real one. Well, I don't really actually know when the last real one was, but I'm glad to see that Harkin and others are saying, we're going to make it a real one this time. If you guys want to do this, we'll do it. Which actually will be harder for Harkin's side, Obama's side, than it will be for the other side because of the constant quorum calls and so on. But we don't want to get into the tall grass on that, but waiting out a filibuster is, if anything, harder than conducting a filibuster, a real old-fashioned filibuster. But the Democrats, I think, and I wrote this at the time, made a serious mistake during the Bush administration when the Republicans threatened the so-called nuclear option.
Right.
Which was, since you can change the filibuster rule with 51 votes, they threatened to change the rule so that filibusters could not be used against a judicial appointment. Now, that had the logic backwards, because judicial appointments are for life. So at least there's some rationale for a supermajority in that case, because you can't undo it after the next election the way you can undo a law. And the Democrats, I think, and wrote actually at the time, they should have taken the dare and they should have said, okay, but it has to be for everything. No, not just judicial. In fact, it should only be for everything but judicial appointments, but we'll compromise. Let's get rid of the filibuster altogether. And that would have meant, yes, it would have meant that Bush would have had his way on more things. But it would have meant that now, the more progressive side, the side that actually wants to do something with government, would get its way. The filibuster, yes, the filibuster has been used to prevent outrages on both sides. But it ultimately serves the interests of those who don't want to do anything and who are dug in and want to preserve the established power structure, the established economic injustice that exists. And the Democrats missed a bet on that one. But I hope it will be made up. I'd really like to see. And I think we will see, if healthcare fails, a movement against the filibuster. But I'd like to see one, even if healthcare succeeds. This is a bad idea, the filibuster.
We're talking with Rick Hertzberg about his latest book, Obamanos, The Birth of a New Political Era. And just happened to have gotten another book of Rick's, which is called 1 Million. And I thought, what is it? I look inside, and it's pages of dots.
Yes, and if you leaf through the whole thing, you will have seen 1 million dots. This is an idea that I woke up with one morning during the hippie era. I think it was 1969. It was 40 years ago.
Wow!
That the first version of 1 million came out. I thought, this is great. I woke up. I jotted the idea down, and it was published in 1970, made me enough money to go and live in England for a year and buy an MG. And since then, there have been two new editions, and now there's this one, which came out at the same moment this month as Obamanos, very nicely designed by Abrams, the art publishing house, though a bargain at whatever they're charging for it. And it has all new, to the extent that it's got words in it, it's got a long introduction, or not too long, not so long that you wouldn't read it with enjoyment, and some other things. That's all new, and the design is all new. But the basic idea, which is, here's a million of something. You want to know how big a million is? Here, look.
Well, I think now you've got to do a billion. I mean,
the billion would take a thousand of those. So you'd kind of have to fill up every shelf in the house to get to a billion. And a trillion, then you'd need 1,000 houses,
right?
Or lined with bookshelves.
Well, also on every page there is some
The little
pertinent facts about, for instance, the $489,900 is the number of dollars minimum cost for a McDonald's franchise in the U.S. in 2002.
Their facts are pretty random, and they're really meant more or less humorously. I stress in the introduction that this is not a reference book. These are kind of suggestions, you know, find your own. But when you do, when you find if something on 258,422, or whatever it is, you know, you can see just how many it is.
1 million.
It's more of a novelty than an actual book.
Right. Well, in Obamanos, you mentioned where you first saw this phrase.
Mm. Yes, I saw it on a dusty road outside Santa Fe, New Mexico. And it just bowled me over. I just it was obvious this is in a Mexican American neighborhood. I later discovered that this was a prominent Obama campaign slogan throughout the Hispanic community, and of course it's a play on vamanos, you know, let's go, vamanos, and vamanos, obamanos, I never considered another title for the book once when that popped into my head, because it sums up so much that was special, that was different about the Obama campaign, including the Yes I Can, Vamanos spirit of it, but also and most prominently, I guess, this ethnic scrambled eggs that the campaign was, and this whole new light, this whole new way of looking at being an American. That had been bumbling under the surface, but had never really had any recognition, not been personified on the national level until Barack Obama, who had all these identities, all these different identities that somehow came together in a harmonious way, and gave a whole new way of looking at the country, and I think evoked a new kind of patriotism, a new kind of love of country that among a lot of people who were perfectly patriotic and who were in the armed forces, I mean, I was, you know, lots of that, but who, well, for me, it's like listening to a Thelonious Monk record, you know, when I listen, or Bob Dylan, you know, when I hear that kind of American music, I think, oh, I'm so proud to be an American. And there's something about Obama that evoked the same feeling.
Well, and it's all right here in Obamanos, and it's published by the Penguin Press.
Mm-hmm.
It's by our guest, Rick Hertzberg, and 1 million is published by Abrams Image, which is also again the latest edition by Rick Hertzberg, and. I appreciate you spending some time with us again.
Oh, it's really been a pleasure. I'm so glad to be back.
Thanks for being with us. Book Talk is now available as a podcast. You can receive an MP3 of Book Talk every week free of charge for your MP3 player or home computer. Links to subscribe to all of KALW's local podcasts are available at kalw.org. And that's Book Talk for this week. This is Alan Farley. Thank you for listening.